We're at the Royal Society in London at the discussion meeting on the new science of ageing with David Gems, who's from University College. A term that would be a surprise to American audiences, a reader in the biology of ageing, which I guess just means lecturer, right? Sort of.
Reader, yeah, it's this British rank. I guess it's like a junior professor.
Right, something like that. And Deputy Director of the Institute of Healthy Ageing. So you're associated with Linda Partridge. And you also write on the ethics of ageing.
A little.
As I understand it. But before we get into this, one thing I wanted to ask you about was this was a review paper that you did in Cell Cycle, Antioxidant Defense and Aging in C. elegans, C. rhabditis elegans, the famous worm. The abstract says, the oxidative damage theory of aging once seemed almost proven, yet recently the buzzards have been assembling in the blue skies above it. New challenges to the theory from work using nematode worms seem set to bring them down to peck at its bones. But is the theory really dead, or does it just need to be modified? And what was your conclusion? And what was the reason for your looking at this? Because this is one of the primary topics in the whole field. And this is a very provocative way of looking at it.
Well, before we switch the camera on, you mentioned the title of the meeting here, The New Biology of Aging. And what's new about this new biology
it's on,
of aging?
By the way.
No, before you switched it on.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I know it's on now. But, I think, as you rightly pointed out, one of the things which is very characteristic of recent work on aging that's different to earlier work is the emphasis on testing mechanisms, testing theories of aging through actually manipulating model organisms to see whether you get the expected response. So you can actually test causality. I think the oxidative damage theory of aging is very much a theory which was developed from studies of correlations between molecular damage and aging. So I think what has changed, it's very much sort of in the vein of the new biology of aging, is to test the theory directly, to actually test predictions of the theory, to see whether you can demonstrate a causal effect of levels of oxidative damage on aging. And that's what's changed. In the last 5 years or so, there have been a series of studies from different labs around the world, some of them using the nematode C. elegans, but some of them in other species, in the mouse particularly. Also the fly, the fruit fly, really testing some of the basic predictions of the oxidative damage theory. And when you do that, quite a lot of the studies haven't supported the theory. They failed to support the predictions of the theory. So I guess the key prediction of the theory there's a sort of popular form of the oxidative damage theory, which is that reactive oxygen is causing aging, particularly reactive oxygen coming from mitochondrial respiration. So the sort of powerhouse of the cell is respiring and generating energy, but also producing as a byproduct reactive forms of oxygen. And the idea is that they cause damage to the cell, which accumulates, and that's the cause of aging. So if that were true, it ought to be the case that if you lower the level of reactive oxygen species, if you can boost the cell's defenses against reactive oxygen species, you should slow aging. Likewise, if you reduce the level of defense against oxidative damage, you should accelerate aging. If you do the latter, you quite often shorten lifespan, certainly in some animal models. But it's not clear whether that's accelerated aging or not. But the real problem is when you overexpress, you don't see, in a lot of recent studies, the expected increases in lifespan. So altogether, I think the implication of that is that this sort of basic simple notion that you have mitochondria producing reactive oxygen and that's causing aging doesn't seem to be supported. So the question that this review is dealing about, apart from reviewing all the sort of damning evidence, is saying, well, so where do we go from here?
Right, and so that's a good, covers like this, Time magazine, The Science of Living Longer, and US News and World Report, How to Live to 100. My point is that they do tend to take some of the earlier pre-review stories and deliver advice to the consumer based on what I think is often quite outmoded or at least suspect data. And I found that a little worrisome. I wonder if you do as well.
I don't know. I mean, the fact is, I mean, the biogerontology, the field of the study of the biology of aging, is still very fragmented.
Yeah.
And it's still a very young field, and there's a lot of confusion within the field at the moment. I mean, there are different theories, different models. There's contradictory data. It can take a long time for a clear picture to emerge from the field, and I think this sort of demise of the oxidative damage theory is something that's happened very, very recently. So it's not really surprising that the media haven't perhaps caught up with that.
What do you think is the, in your view, what's your position at the moment in terms of the things that you do support, the things that you endorse? Which camps are you in? Which camps you think are now outmoded?
I think, I mean, my view is that one of the errors that scientists historically often make is when they're confronted with a little thing that they don't understand, they can deal with it. But when there's a very big thing that they don't understand, something really fundamental that they don't understand, they're not even aware that it's there, that the question is so profoundly unanswered. It's a hard thing to see, something that you really don't know the answer to. There are things that get in the way that make it so that it's not clear that one doesn't know the answer. And I think aging is really a good example of that. I worked on aging for some 15 years, and it actually grows more and more clear to me that there's something fundamentally mysterious about aging that hasn't been solved yet. And the history will also tell you that in any area of science, there are always pre-theories. There are always some theories that predate the kind of the modern theory. And what those pre-theories tend to do is to block the way. They kind of confuse the path to the truth. And in a sense, the present problems with the oxidative damage theory have made me start to wonder whether there's a more fundamental idea in the oxidative damage theory about aging, which is that that it's actually caused by damage per se. That accumulation of damage primarily is what's causing aging, damage of some kind, and that processes that protect against damage are those that promote longevity. And I think what's particularly interesting about the problems with the oxidative damage theory specifically is that they open the possibility that perhaps the whole notion that damage is the primary cause of aging might be wrong. And in some ways, historically you often have these grand ideas that act as kind of intellectual straitjackets that prevent people from doing completely original experiments. Everyone's always assuming that it must be the case that damage is the cause of aging.
Right.
And there are good reasons for that. I mean, aging is associated with damage wherever you look. In whatever organisms you look, you see increase in molecular damage. It goes up exponentially with increasing age. But of course, there's another way of thinking about that, which is to take into account the fact that aging is always a pathological process. It always involves pathology. It always involves disease. One thing about pathology is that pathology is generally associated with increased molecular damage, right? If you have an injury, if you have an infection, if you have inflammation, if you have a stroke, you have massive molecular damage. So from first principles, whatever caused aging even if it wasn't primarily caused by an accumulation of molecular damage, whatever caused aging, you would expect to see an age increase in molecular damage. So, I mean, my own view is, I'm agnostic about this, but I think what's really interesting is to consider, is almost, is to sort of hold in the imagination the possibility that molecular damage theory, if you like, more broadly defined than the oxidative damage theory, may be true, but it may actually be that there's something else which is causing the primary pathologies of aging, and that's producing the molecular damage that's associated with aging.
All right, but an evolutionary argument, an adaptationist argument would say that, you know, function of the organism is to reproduce, you get to a certain reproductive age, and it's all downhill from there. Then it would be extended a little bit and say, well, no, it's actually useful to have grandmothers around and the kin hypothesis and so on and so forth. So one could imagine living a little bit longer to look after offspring and so on. But fundamentally, it's senescence, and each replication produces possible deleterious mutations. So it's all downhill from there. I mean, wouldn't that be the fundamental framework in which this is all posited?
And therefore, that's an interesting question. I think the evolutionary theory is sort of one of the foundations and one of the kind of permanent backgrounds to work on the biology of aging. And I think it's right to assume that aging, why aging is there, can be explained in a very general way by the evolutionary theory. And I think one of the early kind of approaches to try to get to understand the biological mechanisms of aging was to try to use the theory as a foundation for developing ideas about what the biological mechanisms might be of aging. So early on, because of the damage theory of aging and the evolutionary theory, there was a sort of marriage between the two. But that doesn't necessarily, the fact that marriage happened intellectually doesn't mean necessarily that it's true. I think that the evolutionary theory doesn't compel one to assume that molecular damage must be the cause of aging. Not at all.
Right. But what was interesting there was when you were talking about this, and you said there might be some mysterious other explanation.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what's going on in your mind when that's
happening. What might that be?
Is there some sort of cloudy miasma somewhere that is... do you have any sense of what the components and constituents of it are?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a vague idea only. I mean, this is the thing. If you once accept the possibility that there might be some other explanation, you don't need to have another explanation staring you in the face before you start thinking about what... that there might be something there. So there's a sense of that there might be something else there at the moment, coming from various directions. So, you know, I work mainly on the genetics of aging and on various different molecular pathways that control aging. And those include the insulin IGF signaling pathway and the TOR S6 kinase pathway. And those pathways do various things. And I think at the moment the popular view is that somehow these pathways must affect somatic maintenance processes. They must affect repair and maintenance of the cell, and that's how they're having the effects on aging. But that hasn't been demonstrated.
I'm just looking at an October 2009 paper of yours with the whole group. Ribosomal protein S6 kinase 1 signaling regulates mammalian lifespan.
Right. So how is it doing it? What is S6K best known for? It regulates translation of protein.
Right.
And there are a number of different labs have made the same observation that protein synthesis rate seems to have clearly has a strong effect on aging rate. So immediately people said, well, you know, what's protein synthesis got to do with aging? It doesn't make sense. I mean, how's that affecting maintenance and repair? So people then came up with various theories. Well, maybe if you lower the rate of protein synthesis, that allows better protein folding and that reduces levels of molecular damage. But a more heretical idea is to say, well, all these pathways are controlling growth. So maybe somehow what this is telling us, we're trying to kind of shoehorn everything into a maintenance and damage kind of model, but maybe actually it's trying to tell us something else, that growth itself is somehow affecting aging in a way that we don't understand. So this is, I think, is a very interesting new kind of heretical notion, that somehow there's some connection between growth and aging, and we've no idea why, how that works. But as I have to repeat, there's something fundamental about aging that we don't understand. We can make these worms live 10 times longer, up to 10 times longer, by manipulating these signaling pathways. But we really don't know what sort of magical thing we've done to them. We don't know what's actually changed in those worms that's making them live longer. We really haven't got anywhere near that. And somehow the attempts to explain these effects through looking at somatic maintenance processes, they're just not getting there. You know, people have been digging away at this for some time. And I think I could be proven wrong, of course, but I think the field is in a suddenly a much less stable state, if you like.
So you would say, I mean, so fundamentally, there is no generally agreed upon fundamental theory of aging.
I think there's a what I would say is I think there's a very widely held hypothesis. Which I think the theory, the sort of I put forward three theories in the aging, in the cell cycle paper, as sort of alternatives to the kind of traditional oxidative damage theory. One of them is that that somehow oxidative damage of a very diverse kind is causing aging. So if you try to manipulate any one aspect of oxidative damage, there are always other elements of oxidative damage that you're not taking account of. A second idea is to say, well, oxidative damage is only one form of damage, and there are actually a much broader variety of different sources of damage that cause aging. You know, even including things like mechanical damage, wear and tear, and that sort of thing. A good example of something that is not necessarily oxidative damage, but is clearly a form of damage that has a huge impact on health, is the formation of advanced glycation end products. Right. And those often involve reductive reactions. They're not oxidative reactions at all. So there are all sorts of, this the sum of all of the molecular changes contributing to damage that causes aging. I mean, that to me is a far more plausible theory, and I don't think that's anything very controversial. So I would think that some sort of theory like that is probably the sort of center ground, if you like, of ideas at the moment. I think most people still assume that molecular damage accumulation is a primary cause of aging, and that repair and turnover and detoxification kind of processes are those that are actually driving longevity. Mm.
So where do you stand on the notion of whether in fact we have, whether there is an upper limit to lifespan, whether we have a fixed use by date, or whether in fact lifespan can be increased or enormously to the kind of numbers that Aubrey de Grey sometimes talks about?
Yeah, I think, without interventions in the aging process, I think we have something like an upper limit. I mean, I clearly, if you look at the patterns of mortality rates especially among the elderly over the last 30, 40 years, there are some strange things going on. I mean, the mortality rates seem to be dropping and dropping and dropping. It's hard to predict in the future how that will play out. But the fact is that the mortality rates among the elderly are so very high, especially in the oldest old, that despite these drops, you know, effectively, it seems unlikely, you know, without interventions in aging, that there would be major increases in life expectancy overall. I mean, there might be sort of, I wouldn't be surprised if maximum lifespan or the top 1% of survivors, you know, given progress continuing as it is, that doesn't increase somewhat, and you have more people living, a great deal more people living to be 110 and even to older ages, but in the end, you're still talking about a very small number of people. In terms of whether one could ever develop you know, for example, from the new biology of aging, treatments for human aging that would extend lifespan. I mean, it's certainly, if animal models are anything to go by, then the answer is surely yes. It would seem odd if humans were some way fundamentally different. I think the existence of the bowhead whale is a very good kind of point of reference here, because individual bowhead whales can survive for more than 200 years, which tells us that human longevity, which is remarkable among mammals, is still far from the ceiling of possible longevity among mammals. So I mean, I think in terms of where the science is going at the moment, I think it's heading very palpably towards some sorts of treatments for aging, which would take the form of interventions, pharmacological interventions that would lead to decelerated aging. So it would be something like a kind of preventative medicine for older people to decelerate their aging rate. So that the consequence of that would be a retention of health into later life. So it wouldn't mean an extension of sort of the moribund stage of life, you know. It would mean you'd have some more years of youth and health. And I think this has to be a good thing.
What do you take from the research? Is there anything that then you put into your own personal life?
Me?
Or do you advise other people to do?
No.
If they ask you when you're at a dinner party and then you say that you work on aging, they say,
sure.
Oh, what should I be doing?
Well, I don't really. I tell people about things that look really interesting. And sometimes people, you know, get excited about that. I mean, an obvious example of that would be something like metformin, which is, you know, widely used for treating type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. But the fact is that, you know, you don't really know with humans. I mean, this is extrapolating from animal models to humans is risky, and you can even get the opposite of what you wanted. I think a good example of that, a good object lesson, would be something like hormone replacement therapy for women. I mean, there was a lot of women who I think, even thinking, well, you know, we don't know the long-term effects of hormone replacement therapy, but, you know, even if it's a chance of living longer, this has got to be a good thing. And it all makes good sense. It's all logical. You lose your estrogen levels drop, you replace them, and you stay younger and feel better and all the rest of it. But of course, we now know that it causes major increases in risks of developing various kinds of cancer. So I think, you know, I would say that what's really needed is just energy from all concerned parties in the process of bringing the benefits, potential benefits from the current science to full testing. I think it's rash. You know, there are so many examples of things that looked like they might be a hope for slowing aging. And the argument is always, well, you know, if it's a hope, what have we got to lose? But actually, you can actually lose out. You know, look at growth hormone. You know, growth hormone is something which, I don't know, a lot of people take growth hormone, and it's really potentially very harmful. So I think, from my point of view, at the moment our work is suggests that metformin might be a good way to slow aging, but I wouldn't take metformin.
But beyond the usual exercise well and blah blah blah,
that's right. Exercise,
glass of red wine.
Make sure I have actually for the sake of my health, I try to drink a bit more. I'm inclined not to drink. And I sort of think, well, I should really drink. And I buy, you know, I like a whiskey every now and again, so I could buy some really nice whiskey to try and get myself to drink a little more, so I can be a bit less kind of highly strung, and it would be good for my health. And I ride a bicycle everywhere, you know, kind of, which definitely does me a lot of good. But that's all. I mean, I'd love to be able to, I would, if I thought that, if we could get some good data on metformin, even from retrospective studies of existing data, of which there's a lot for metformin, showing that very clearly that there was a generalized effect on aging. Of course, I'd take it. But if you
took your argument and extended it across the field, I mean, if you said, look, hormone replacement therapy, you know, sounded like a good idea, logical, trouble is cancers go up. Mm. And then somebody would turn around and say, well, of course, I mean, you're messing with a system there that was designed by natural selection to peter out at a certain age. That's the way it is. I mean, you're interfering. You're playing God. You do stuff on the ethics of aging. You're into that territory right now in extending lifespan by however you wish to do it. Aren't you messing? Mm.
Well, I mean, I would, to me, that's a similar argument to saying if one were to use antibiotics, for example, to lower infant mortality rate. I mean, that's, if you want to look at something that's caused a very large effect on life expectancy, on lifespan, it's reducing infant mortality rate. It's artificial, but we do it because we think it's right. I think the primary point of reference is health and protection against disease, and ultimately it's protection against suffering and promotion of well-being. And I think there are some differences between treating aging and treating individual diseases like, say, cancer or smallpox or whatever, but the differences are not as great as people think. I think one of the reasons for the confusion, in my own view, is the misconception that aging is not a disease. Aging itself is not a disease. I think if you look at the biology of aging, even if you look at the evolutionary biology of aging, why aging is there, in most respects, it looks like a disease. It looks like a disease syndrome. So the distinction is sometimes made between sort of healthy aging and the diseases of aging, as if one can really separate the two, as if there's some sort of natural process of aging, biological aging. They're not chronological aging, but some sort of biological change which is somehow neutral or benign. And you can separate all these pathologies that go with it. I think that's really, if you look at it from a biological perspective, that's just not a coherent view. There is one process, which is the aging process, which is a disease syndrome with many, many different forms of pathology associated with it: cancer, cardiovascular disease, neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's and so on. And what the animal model studies really tell us, particularly the recent rodent studies, is that if you intervene in aging, you get a broad spectrum protection against all of it. And I think given the benefits to health of intervening in aging in terms of reducing disease and reducing suffering, I think ethically, we simply have to pursue that course. And to be honest, I spent quite a lot of years worrying about the possible implications of life extension and what my research, this field might achieve. But to be honest, what worries me most now is that the potential is there to avoid suffering on a massive scale. And what really worries me is that there will be a number of delays and problems and obstacles to the potential of the field being realized in terms of benefits for older people.
Yeah. So your talk, the title of your talk, which you'll be giving later, is the prospects for treating human aging.
Yeah, and the sub heading is ethical perspectives.
What's the
talk about? Yeah. Well, I think the talk is essentially an exploration of the reasons for being worried about treating aging. People sort of assume within the field that this research is leading towards treatments for aging. But when you look carefully at what that means, it's a very thorny and complex area. This is not like finding a new cure for the common cold. Treating aging is another matter altogether. And there are all sorts of views about it. So the talk is, to some extent, surveys the various different opinions about aging, including what's sometimes called life cycle traditionalism, the notion that that the aging process is part of a sort of necessary cycle of life that gives human existence meaning, which is a widely held view. The council of the chair of the President's Council on Bioethics under George Bush, it's a very beautiful writer called Leon Kass, a philosopher, writes very well, but very much arguing for the life cycle traditionalism. So to some extent, I think my own view is that many of the arguments of life cycle traditionalism don't hold up very well. But there are a small number of things that do concern me about the biology of aging and its applications to treating aging. And I can give you one of them, which is a sort of a new idea. So where the research is leading us at the moment is towards decelerated aging. That's what you can achieve in the laboratory. And this is very helpful in terms of looking at the ethics of it all, because ethics is not generally, to act ethically, kind of philosophical arguments about moral philosophy are, you know, they may be helpful sometimes, but in reality, often what is more important are the facts, the actual facts of the reality that you're dealing with. And in this case, the fact that where the research is leading is decelerated aging is actually immediately removes a number of ethical concerns about aging. So one of them is the idea that you'll produce treatments that will leave people sort of wheelchair-bound and bedridden for decades. In the laboratory, decelerated aging doesn't do that. It makes you stay younger for longer. It might slightly extend your sort of moribund phase of your life, but it's going to extend all phases of your life. But one of the odd things about decelerated aging is that people often ask, well, these mice, you know, they're living longer, but what do they actually die of? And this is a very interesting question, because the answer is, well, they kind of tend to die of a lot of the same sorts of things that untreated mice die of. It's just later. And people will respond to that by saying, well, so have we really gained anything then? You know, you're not, so lifetime cancer risk, let's say, might not actually be changed, but the likelihood of getting cancer at any given age will be greatly reduced. So what sort of benefit is that? I've thought about this, and my view here is that it is a benefit. It's a huge benefit, but it takes a new perspective on what medical research achieves to be able to see it. And that perspective I can kind of illustrate to you with an example, which is smallpox. Mm. So one of the great achievements of medical science was to completely eradicate smallpox from the world. It used to be an endemic around the world, a terrible, debilitating disease. So it was a great thing. But one of the consequences of eradicating smallpox was to increase the frequency of Alzheimer's disease. It must have been, because more people were surviving smallpox to live to old age. And the point here, when you think about it, any major breakthrough in healthcare has that quality. Essentially, if you think about lifetime likelihood of disease, that's something which is almost a constant, right? Mm-hmm. Because we all die. And, you know, some people seem to be in fairly good shape when they die, but actually they're not, because they have died because of a range of various problems that they have. You know, you don't just stay healthy and then die. You die because you're ill, because of aging. So essentially, that's actually what decelerated aging would achieve. Instead of kind of getting rid of smallpox here now and replacing it with Alzheimer's later, you're essentially getting rid of all the diseases of aging now and having perhaps the same diseases later. But in the end, what you've actually achieved is the same thing. In a way, you can measure the eradication of any disease in terms of simply the delay of the inevitable, which is death from pathology. And decelerated aging has the potential for doing this on a massive scale. So I think in that sense, decelerated aging is a great, is can be of enormous benefit as in terms of health.
What people say is that they would like to achieve is this long plateau of health and then just fall off at the end there. But I think they have in mind Monday to Tuesday.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, this is a good point,
Monday,
yeah.
And on Tuesday, I don't know, what is death of natural causes?
I think this is a good point. And actually, it's interestingly, it's a notion that has been much discussed in the ethical realm. And Leon Kass, for example, has made lovely comments about the value of aging and what a nightmarish scenario this would actually be, to actually sort of stay young and then die. In some ways, there's a view that aging is a preparation for death. Completely end all of that by saying that based on the way that what the research is showing us is possible at the moment, it's not on the cards. It's just not. Yeah. That's what's interesting about ethics, I think, very often, is to when you have new findings from science, new realities about the world, you can then start to deal with those and think about those as concrete likelihoods. And I think this idea of staying young and then dropping dead, I think it's at the moment it's simply not something that's likely to happen.
Yeah, and this would be another conversation we should have some other time, but there was an enormous big fat volume came out of Dr. Kass's committee, which was called Human Dignity.
Yeah.
And there's some very interesting papers written about that, including an article by Steve Pinker called The Stupidity of Human Dignity, because he thought they were taking the wrong tack on that. But that's a tricky issue. I mean, the folk psychological, you know, the nice cuddly idea of human dignity is one thing, but when you actually start unpacking it, it's a rather trickier issue, and does start getting into the territory you're talking about, which is, well, let's go beyond the nice words. And let's talk about the practical story here.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It can be hard to look these facts in the face sometimes.
I mentioned this to you yesterday. I just read this to Richard Farragher as well. There's this quote from Lear that I mentioned to you, where Reagan says to Lear, "Oh, sir, you are old. Nature in you stands on the very verge of her confine. You should be ruled and led by some discretion that discerns your state better than you yourself." So what we're talking about there, again, is how much independence people have as they get into this final state of this final years of life, the final stage, and how much autonomy they retain. Is that something that you deal with as well? How much dignity they're left with at the end as they go down the various final pathways, the final palliative pathways?
Not really. I mean, in a way, my concern is more the push from our field is towards decelerating aging, extending youth span, and protecting against disease. So in a sense, my major concern, because it's what I work on every day, is whether this could be the wrong thing. I mean, one of the things that, of all of the apologist arguments, actually it's not an apologist argument, of all of the arguments for aging, let's say, that worry me, there's only one that really sticks in my mind. And it's the fact that one thing that aging does is that it frees nations from tyrants. And I think about, one example, someone like Mao Zedong, who was really responsible for the deaths of some 70 million people in his own country in peacetime. And let alone the suffering of the remainder of the Chinese population, apart from a few small number of party people. I mean, if, you know, that is just an unalloyed good. Aging got rid of Mao from the world, and that was an extraordinarily good thing. And the idea that we could be developing therapies that would keep people like Mao alive really frightens me. I mean, it's routinely one can double the lifespan of C. elegans. You know, if therapies based on that, just for the sort of sake of argument, had been available in the last century, Mao would be something like in the equivalent of his mid-50s. He'd still be in charge. probably hundreds of millions of Chinese would have died by now.
Well, in fact,
who knows how many wars would have been started.
People will benefit from this largely. I mean, this is a conversation with Tuck Finch. He talks about the fearful specter of health elites.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the problem. In the current age, we'd be worrying about super tycoons, oligarchs, press barons, you know, people like this getting more and more and more powerful. One thing about aging is that it limits individual power. It limits the accumulation of individual power over time. Maybe it's because I was very political when I was younger, but it's a political dimension of aging research, which is very, very serious. Yeah. It's very serious. It's a real danger for humanity in the long run.
How did you get into this business in the first place? Well, I mean, when you said you were younger, what was the trajectory? How did you get into science at all?
Oh, that's a long story. By a twisted route, which would take too long to explain. Part of it is a desire to change the world and transform the world for the better. You know, I was very much on the left, and the left has left us. And I think one finds quite a few idealists among scientists who want to transform the world for the better, work for the good of humanity.
Was it science something that interested you at school or something?
Not really. No, I did art at school, funnily enough. I changed in my late teens. I went back to school again and decided that I could see genetics having the capacity to change the world in various ways.
Your parents weren't scientists or anything?
No, my mother and my brother are both playwrights. No scientists in the family.
So all a very artistic background all there.
It's all the same, really. It's writers and artists and scientists. They're all basically the same species, creative people.
So you actually buy the notion of the two cultures would not be you would not support that.
Oh no, that is a problem. That's definitely a problem. But I mean, as a sort of psychological types,
the act of creation,
the activity is quite similar. Yeah, it's pretty similar. I think there's more similarity between a geneticist and a writer than there is between a geneticist and a surgeon.
Well, I've been asking people. And especially in this setting, 350th anniversary year of the Royal Society, the importance of science in society. In his inaugural address, President Obama talked about restoring science to its rightful place. What do you think the rightful place of science is?
I guess I would understand that statement in terms of a commitment towards progressive politics. The idea that human society, you know, human life is a progressive process. It's a constant process of evolution and change and development, including political systems, social systems. Everything changes and evolves and develops. And one of the things that carries that along and drives it forward is the development of ever better a picture of reality and of the world. We become wiser and we understand our world better and better. And that should drive the whole kind of progressive process. I think that means that science is not simply a tool for sort of kind of generating new profitable products or even sort of new technologies to benefit industry or something like this, or medicine. It's something much broader than that. It's something that informs the whole thing, you know. I think that's how I would take that's how, I think probably what he was meaning.
Right. You have to go and give your talk, David James. Thanks very much.